Hi, and welcome to the Worldcraft Club show, a show for writers, dungeon masters, and other storytellers who want to create rich, immersive worlds that will bring their audience back time and time again. I am joined here by the estimable Seth Ring.
I'm here.
And producer Dave. And today we're going to talk about adaptations. Adaptations are this really interesting topic, and a lot of times, like if you're ever on any sort of nerdy channels whatsoever, you're going to get into fights about adaptations, right? Like, I'm thinking Lord of the Rings, right? You're going to get some folks who are going to look at the Peter Jackson adaptation and go, why didn't he have Tom Bombadil or Old Man Willow in it? And they're going to get furious. You're going to get other people who are going to say, M. Night Shyamalan sucks. Why did he screw up Avatar The Last Airbender? And you're going to just get a lot of strong feelings about it in the nerd community. But I think there's actually something very useful we can take out of this as world builders. When you start moving a product from its original intended purpose, its original medium, and you shift it into another media, you're going to run into some issues with tone and recognition. Like, part of the reason why I think Jackson's adaptation of Lord of the Rings was so successful is because he embraced the core of what Tolkien was going for. And Tolkien's known for being, as I put it, a bit of an ink bag, right? Like, he kind of goes a bit nuts on his descriptions and depth. So that's what Jackson did. I think it's an interesting thing to talk about. And I think there are some practical applications for our world building in it. So I thought it would be worth getting together here with Seth and diving into it. So Seth, is there a favorite adaptation you have? And why is it Dune, where Sting was in a diaper?
I haven't actually seen
that one. The 1970s Dune. Oh, it's bad.
I know that's a sin.
It's good and bad.
Well, right.
It's so bad, it's good.
And that's the large, obvious reason that I often avoid adaptations.
You just avoid them.
I'm one of those people who likes to live under a rock.
Yeah.
Because I know that the last thing I see is probably going to be how I imagine the things I've read. Mm. And so for movie adaptations in particular, I think they have just a tremendous amount of power to reshape our understanding of whatever it is we had engaged with.
Yeah.
So Lord of the Rings is a great example of that.
Yeah,
great example of a great adaptation.
Yeah.
The Hobbit, maybe not so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a number of problems in production as well. It just made it hard.
Yeah, there.
I want to see Guillermo del Toro's Hobbit. Okay. Honestly, like, I would have gone nuts for that. I think that would have been rad and whimsical and weird, and it would have been so cool.
And I think that, you know, to your point, the tone and the core concept matters so much. It matters so incredibly much. And when we adapt something, unless we can capture that tone and core concept, it's not going to work the way the original did. That doesn't mean that an adaptation is automatically bad.
Yeah.
Right? If it's not exactly what the original was, it just makes it different. And so the metrics to judge it are then apples to oranges instead of apples to apples.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting that you might say good adaptations exist because the initial creator had a strong enough core concept that it was communicated to whoever was making the adaptation. And so I think that's an interesting mark of a fantastic story to say, hey, here's the story, find the core concept and adapt it.
Yeah. I've got these really interesting illustrated Harry Potter books.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like a limited run, and me and my wife have been collecting them. And it is a completely different take on Harry Potter than the movies presented. And the movies set the
set the tone
for the imagination and how we view it. And so I've been, you know, reading through these books, and it is an illustrator, very gifted illustrator, who creates these extremely eclectic drawings with just lots of junk around there in the image. And they show these great portraits of like the different characters and kind of like how he imagines them. It's very hard to imagine Snape not being Alan Rickman, you know, and it's just like it's it but he does such a good job of drawing these different scenes that you kind of find yourself like going, oh, like this is how it could have looked, you know, this is mm-hmm. this is the way it could have been. And being British, I crave disappointment, so like I pursue like, you know, these adaptations, like I like watching them, I do get excited about them.
Yeah.
Over time I've gotten jaded. Like Mortal Engines mm-hmm. is another one.
Yep.
they buggered it up. Who did that one? Do you remember who? I think that might have even been Peter Jackson. Might have been Peter Jackson. But like, I saw the trailer for that. I never watched the movie, but I saw the trailer and was like, "Cities on Wheels, freaking awesome!" And so I read the whole series.
Yeah.
On the basis of the trailer, and loved those books. They're freaking cool. They're outlandish and weird
mm-hmm.
and like a pretty dark, but they're really cool. And like, I can't wait for my son to read them, but the trailer is what did it for me. When I found out the movie sucked, I skipped the movie. I was just like, I'll just read the books.
Right.
And like had a really good time. And it's one of my pastimes as well, is I have this habit of just finding random media that people just enjoy, mm-hmm. like a movie or something like that, and be like, oh, the book was way better, even if there's never been a book written about it, just to kind of see what they'll do with that. Like, nothing like the book. Like,
yeah.
So it's like, I have this conflicted feeling about adaptations as well.
Sure.
And like, I kind of get that. And I'm thinking even now about like the Dune adaptation. And you know, I mm-hmm. joked about it before, Sting in a Diaper. It's how I'm going to cosplay to the second part of, you know, the Villeneuve mm-hmm. like redo of it. Like, I don't think I have his lithe frame though. But like, it's...
it'll look fantastic.
Oh, it looks so good. People will know immediately and they'll be like, please come into our theater and watch a movie. You will not disturb onlookers. But like, no, it's that adaptation was like, honestly, like it's regarded as being really campy and really right. crappy, but like at the end of the day though, it was really it shaped my view of the books. And then when I read the books, I was like, oh, this is like, you know, pretty darn different to that.
Yes,
you know, like yeah. In fact I watched the first Lord of the Rings before I read the books.
Yeah. And a lot of people have had that experience.
Yeah.
Right. And so forever the story is imagined through the lens of the movie. And you know what's really interesting, talking about how creators, you know, treat a core concept?
Yeah.
I think one of the problems with The Hobbit was that when the books were written, they had very, like when The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings were written, they had very different core concepts.
Yeah.
But when Peter Jackson went to make the movie, he still had his core concept from Lord of the Rings.
Mm.
And he brought that into The Hobbit, which is a completely different story. Yeah. And it's fascinating because...
That's a very good point.
It's fascinating because in film, in a series, or in a connected universe, it is very difficult to build two core concepts because we think about them as a unified universe.
Mm. It's a very materialist approach.
Like absolutely.
We need there to be consistency between
right.
the two.
And it's because I think there's the visual element. Whereas in books, it's a lot easier for an author to build in the same world multiple core concepts and take things in very, very different directions.
Yeah.
And so you can have books in the same space that are not unified in their core concept, but it's so hard to do with movies.
Yeah, no, I really see what you mean. And the thing that's funny is that The Hobbit, like I was talking to a friend of mine who said, you know, if I was going to do The Hobbit, I'd do a 10-part miniseries because like basically The Hobbit is just a collection of interrelated
right.
stories and you could just sort of do them episodically. I love
yep.
reading it to my son because I can read parts of it
exactly.
and then that part is done. And then I move on to the next part. It's the same characters. It's the same
right.
overall adventure, but now they're in the Goblin Cave and they've got to solve
right.
that problem. And now they're,
right.
you know, at Beorn's... house and
mm-hmm.
like, you know, there's this going on and like it's fascinating and just the wonder and the descriptions and all of it, like experiencing, like watching, like getting to tell my son these stories
mm-hmm.
and imagining what he's imagining and having him beg me to stay in the room, like to read him a little bit more of the story is brings a tear to my eye. It's so
mm-hmm.
satisfying. And like, and there's a way in which like a visual adaptation of a story like takes a little of that away.
It does.
And kind of puts that, and like, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, I right. honestly, like, Lord of the Rings, like, again, like, the particularly the extended editions, I you know, will watch those and will still cry at the points you're supposed to cry at, which is obviously the charge of the Rohirrim on Pelennor Fields. Right. I cry every time. Death! Death! Like, it's just, oh, Theoden's just the best. But, like, that's kind of... That those movies do have an interaction, but it's not the same as the books. And, right. and there's this difference, this very deep tonal difference between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, despite yeah. them being in the same universe. And you cannot just slap the aesthetic that you had on Lord of the Rings and put it on Doodah Dally singing in the valley in Lord of the Ring in right. The Hobbit when they reach Rivendell.
Right.
You know, it's like, it doesn't work.
So interestingly, my children just saw The Hobbit
yes.
movies this past weekend. Okay. The first thing that my daughter, who's 12, says to me when I ask her how she liked the movies, she said, they made the elves so serious.
Yeah.
Right? Because in The Hobbit, there is a flippancy to them that...
They're fae.
That, right. That doesn't... But that doesn't translate into, like, the way they're treated in Lord of the Rings is different from the way they're represented in The Hobbit, yeah. right? And so she's coming into this having read The Hobbit and expecting this sort of
very you're expecting light some silliness adventure and
right
like, yeah
and there's a lightness to The Hobbit,
yeah,
that even though there are these dark moments and these intense things,
yeah, and I mean
the way it's treated
the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, but the way it's treated from a literary perspective is much lighter than the way it's treated in Lord of the Rings. The language is different.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's intended for a different audience.
Yeah.
And so I think with anybody who is setting out to create adaptations of something, I think it's unbelievably important to really understand that tone, to really understand that core concept. Mm. On the opposite side, though, I think that if you are a world builder and you are interested in having your properties adapted,
yeah,
it makes sense then to spend a lot of time and be very intentional about how you communicate your core concept.
Yeah.
So that even when somebody comes and says, I like this thing, I want to make a new thing out of it, because really every adaptation is a completely new work of art, right?
Yeah.
When somebody comes and says that, if your core concept is strong enough, they're going to be able to do it and hopefully do it well, as yeah. long as they are, you know, a competent artist.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
that's
I mean,
that's the trick.
Well, one of the things that's being discussed right now is even like Starship Troopers mm-hmm. and the movie adaptation of that book. And apparently the guy who created that movie read the first chapter of Starship Troopers, thought it was dumb as all get out, yep. and just did whatever he wanted with it.
Yeah.
And like, it was like sort of a bizarre commentary on like fascism, people playing Helldivers right now. Like,
yeah.
I feel like a lot of like that sort of, you know,
yeah.
yay, we'll bring you democracy, whether you like it or not. Like, filthy Xenos, kind of like a lot of that kind of comes from like that, almost that Starship Troopers adaptation. But Starship Troopers was honestly a very different novel than that. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, I mean, it's kind of a certain stripe of sci-fi novel. Like, I'm not saying like he didn't pick up on all the stuff in there that was like present, but like it was just very, very different, you mm-hmm. know, and had Neil Patrick Harris just like placing his palm on the head of a brain bug and going, it's afraid at the end. You know, it's like that stuff was not there at all. It was mostly about powered armor suits diving into like, right. There's a lot of military sci-fi sort of technology focused stuff in that. And like, there were weird ways that the cultures were sort of organized and military service. And like, there was like, a, you know, kind of a strong sort of fascistic element through it. Mm-hmm. And I get what he's talking about with that and like the way the governments worked. But what he did was functionally a parody. Right. Of what the book was trying to do. It's an interesting topic. And I know there's been like lots of back and forth about this. I don't necessarily want to like kick that beehive per se, but it's an interesting question in adaptation. You'll get somebody right. who comes at it from a completely different perspective and has disdain for the source material
yeah.
and thinks it's really not worth the time. And like,
do you think it would be helpful in this discussion for me to shed some light on the way adaptations get made?
Yeah, I think that's interesting.
I have a little bit of insight into this. Yeah, I'd love that. So one of my properties is currently being adapted into a webcomic.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's been fascinating to watch that process and talking to other authors who have had their books adapted into movies. Mm. It's just fascinating to understand how this process works.
Yeah.
When someone comes to you and says, I want to, you know, take your property and I want to create it again in another media, the primary concern of the person who's funding is ability to make money.
Yeah.
Right? That's it. There is no artistic drive behind the person who is funding. Because normally it's a company that's doing it, right?
Yeah.
So what they do then is they look around and they try to find someone who has the creative chops to complete the project, but they actually want it to be distinct enough that it is not a carbon copy. Because they would rather the adaptation be the primary driver than a thing that is coming along after. Does that make sense? So functionally, they would rather people come in to that space, to whatever that IP is, through their product than through your product. So they don't want people to read the books and then go, oh, great, there's a webcomic. They would rather people read the webcomic and then be like, oh, interesting, there are books. Because when you control the gate into an IP, it gives you a lot more control over the audience.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is the economics of the adaptation business, right? And I think for creators, it's incredibly important that we don't just understand the world building and the creative piece, but that we also understand why people make these things.
Yeah.
We would like to believe as creatives that it's because the property is really good.
Yeah.
And it's because they love it and they are excited about it and they're just creating it in a new medium because that's the medium that they create in.
Yeah.
But the reality is that people don't make adaptations unless they think they can make money off of them.
Yeah.
And so that's a hard reality as a creator for me to be like, I wrote this book and this series and I love it and it's so cool and I'm excited that somebody else wants to come and create in this space. Mm-hmm. And they not only want to create, they like my thing enough that they're going to recreate it in a new medium.
Yeah.
Any creator who is going into an adaptation with that mindset is going to get burned.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's not why people do it.
Well, you're going to wind up with something that is going to be different. Like, I don't think it's possible to make an adaptation without effectively pissing off a few fans.
Yeah, like that's for sure.
It's just not something you can do. And some of it is just the realities of a medium switch.
Yes.
Like going to, like, Tom Bombadil would have been ridiculous in Lord of the Rings. In the way that the movies had to play, in the way that the narrative had to flow. Right. There were things like, technically, you know, when Gandalf goes off to research the ring, he disappears for like 20 years. Like, it's like a while. Like, Frodo is in his 50s when he leaves the Shire. Like, he has had, like that's middle age for like a hobbit. So, like, you know, but Elijah Wood was like in his 20s and they kind of like needed that sort of vibe, like, as he was leaving. And like, that's all of that's fine. It was what was needed for the movie and it was what was needed to visually present it.
Right.
And they didn't want quite like
it's much more sympathetic when the main character is young and naive.
Yeah.
Versus a 50-year-old dude who's probably been around the block a few times. Just kind of wants to
sit down and put his feet up.
Yeah.
Like, and but like
that a was, very different adventure.
And I could see people being frustrated by things like that, you know, and they miss things like the scouring of the Shire and things like that. And like, there's lots of things that, you know, you could be upset about. But it was partly they had to make something that worked well. One thing that's interesting is that they also did not have the author to advocate for his vision.
Yeah.
They just had the text, but which is a remarkable testament to how clear Tolkien's vision is in
absolutely.
The text.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sorry.
Even if they had the author, though.
Yeah.
Again, it's hard. I live in this world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
and so
yeah,
it's hard
yeah.
for me to get past this, but like most of the contracts you sign give you absolutely zero creative control.
Oh.
I got an email. And in the email, it said, here are some questions for the authors of these properties that we are adapting. Here are the questions we have. You can ask them if you want, or just give us the answer if you don't need to ask them.
Mm.
Right. And the implication was, in the contract that I signed my right or my rights over to them. They now have the right to adapt this. It's not per my approval.
Yeah.
So if they want to change a story point, and I feel very fortunate that the people I'm working with are fantastic, right?
Yeah.
And we can talk about it. But if they want to change a story point, they can change a story point.
Yeah.
And as the creator, I don't get a say in that.
Yeah.
Unless they're willing to give me one. But most people, when you are doing a project like that, you cannot afford, from a finances standpoint, you cannot afford to wait until the author is totally happy with how it's portrayed.
Yeah.
Right? You make your decisions and you do the best you can, and then you hope it goes over with the audience.
Yeah.
Right?
And there's also just the simple realities of changing a medium. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like
absolutely.
And moving over and
absolutely.
Having to tell, like, you know, turning a book into a TV show or
right.
or a movie or a comic, indeed.
Right.
Like, you're going to have different things you're focusing on and different languages that you're going to be trying to communicate in.
And the amount of time that passes, like, we don't often think about how time affects stories, but the medium you use determines how you have to treat time.
Yeah.
When I write a book, I can spend an entire chapter describing a scene or setting the stage so that in the next chapter I can execute what I want, the story I want to execute.
Yeah.
When you're shooting a movie, you cannot spend...
You have 3 seconds of footage
exactly.
to convey that before the scene needs to
exactly.
happen.
Exactly. You can't spend a chapter's worth of time, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, however long it takes you to read a chapter.
Yeah.
Like, you can't spend that amount of time getting the person who's experiencing this, your visitant, in that frame of mind.
Yeah.
And so it necessitates different choices, right, from a storytelling perspective. And I think that often as fans, we don't appreciate the level of difficulty that goes into making an adaptation that feels the same, even if it's in different medium.
Yeah. And I think that really comes back down to this idea of a strong core concept. And to kind of drive a lot of this home, and really what I think a lot of world builders can take from this, is that in a lot of ways, the ease of translation from one medium to another depends very much on how clearly you have presented your vision as a creator.
Yes.
Right? Like, there needs to be an easily understandable vision to follow. Now Tolkien partly is memorable because he had such a distinct and well covered, well explained vision. There is a vibe. There is nearly a completely separate Tolkien-y feeling you can have when you think about Middle Earth and you go, ooh, that's Tolkien. You know, that's similar to that. And that vision allowed Peter Jackson to create an incredible adaptation. It's also interesting ones like The Expanse is another one. They turned it into a TV series, and they changed a lot to make it work for a TV show. There is one character who is Kara Ji, who is an incredible actress, and they basically had her play, I think, 3 to 4 of the different characters through the story. They just wove her in very, very well through it. So she plays one character, Camille Drummer, who they were like, she can fill this role.
Right.
And she can do this thing. And she can do this thing. So there's like three different characters. There's a bull in Michio Pa that she plays technically going through it. So they just eradicated those characters and just had Drummer in those, mostly because this character was just incredible in the way that they played it. And I'm a huge fan of that. They actually had the creators of the books like heavily involved in the creation of the show. But a lot of that was just that reasonable flexibility kind of allowed in it. But the retention of tone, the retention of the vision,
so,
and the key conflicts.
So what's interesting, though, about that interplay is I wonder if, because, and correct me if I'm wrong here, The Expanse was originally for a video game, right?
It was, yeah.
And so
yeah.
Video games are as close to movies as you can get without being movies, right? Yeah. There is cinematic directing that's happening. It's just that you're expecting the visitant to embody the main character as opposed to simply observe the main character, right?
Yeah.
And so the way you create a video game is very much the way you create a movie.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that's part of what allowed those creators allowed for the feeling that the creators originally made in The Expanse to be captured so well.
I wonder. And it is fascinating. And again, kind of like drive this home. It's like I kind of feel like a lot of times, you know, we're going to be like a broken record with this.
Absolutely.
But it's like it comes down to the clarity of the concept that you're dealing with. The way that like Tolkien has this expansive world that feels deep and rich in meaning. There was a certain commitment to the beauty of nature and the honoring of humble things that was very important, that drove through the story. You could see it, made it very, I don't want to say easy to adapt, but it made it clear.
Right.
The Expanse was a lot of the hard science fiction elements, drawing upon those, and the idea about politics, and that we're still dealing with humans in space with their own different ideologies and perspectives, and how difficult it is for people to get along. It was like a very major theme of that. And they were able to highlight that and capitalize on that and make a very interesting story as a result of it. This is where a lot of those kind of good adaptations come, and that clear understanding of what's going. Now, there's other issues. I mean, there's like character and things like that. Like, I honestly think Mortal Engines is one of my favorite ones to talk about. I think that book series is incredible, like basically teenage, like kind of science fiction, fantasy stuff. Very clear, fun concept. They nailed it visually, but the story just, they just fell over on it in the movie. Like, they just didn't do it right. Right. But like, in terms of like the vibe, they got it like 100% right. It's one of those movies that like nailed it on world building, but like fell over on the story. Like, I'm just like, oh, that's a really cool concept. Too bad it sucked. You know, like,
that's unfortunate.
Yeah, Jupiter Ascending is my favorite one of that. Wicked cool world building. Nobody's going to believe Eddie Redmayne's a villain. He is too nice and everybody wants their daughters to marry him. So, like, there's just no getting away from it. That's my personal belief on that. You can, you know, Google that. But, anyway, like this all kind of comes down to this strong core concept, whatever you're doing. And by core concept, we mean the vibe that you're shooting for in your world.
Yes.
It's almost reverse engineering your world, stopping for a moment and going like, what was that thing I'm trying to create? Was it the sense of foreboding at looking into deep water and not knowing what's going? Is that what's going there? Like that's sort of an H.P. Lovecraft cosmic horror kind of vibe. What's beyond the darkness? Or investing in a sort of light and airy. We were talking about Borderlands, soon to be adapted into a TV series, and like how that has a certain vibe and a feel to it that they're gonna try to capture in that. Who knows whether they'll nail the story, but that first vibe is like kind of a critical part as far as world building is concerned with the media and adaptation.
Yeah. I love that idea of the feeling that you're trying to communicate to your visitant. How do you want your visitant to feel when they're done?
Yeah.
Right. And for all the differences, I feel like Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, captured enough of that feeling that people had when they were done with the books that it just, it's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
Even among people who were annoyed that certain parts were missing, right, they still will begrudgingly, begrudgingly acknowledge.
Yeah, they'll say it's good.
Yeah. And so that really wraps it up for this conversation about adaptation, right? We're seeking to create something. If you're writing a book, you're playing a D&D campaign, anything like that, starting off from that basic question of where do I want my audience to go with this? What is it that I want them to feel? Where did I want them to land? And sort of reverse engineering that into a concept that can be worked with. That's kind of a lot of where adaptation comes from. Did it feel the same going from one to another? There's a lot that can be forgiven as long as the vibe is retained, that sense of core concept and tone. So, what's the worst adaptation you've seen and why did it suck? Especially if you can talk about world building elements or places where people just miss the mark. I think this is a lot of fun. I don't like to dwell too much on negativity, but like, I think this is an interesting thing to talk about because I think it can help you understand how your world building can be improved by getting that sort of, making sure there's alignment in there as you go through your series or develop your campaigns. So with that, I'm James. Seth's over there. Producer Dave is there. Editor AJ is everywhere. And it's in Valheim. And we want to wish you a lovely day from the Worldcraft Club podcast. Thank you for watching.